This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. Today on the program, we are airing a discussion from last week on the most recent proposal from Utah state legislators to expand Medicaid. It's a contentious topic. Nearly 2 years have passed since legislators could have granted greater health care options to low-income Utahns under an expansion of Medicaid. Still, Utah Republicans who control the state House and Senate have balked at the expansion as required under the 2010 Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare. Even after months of different proposals and negotiations, many behind closed doors, and even the creation of a special committee of six lawmakers to hash out a plan, there is still no plan certain to pass. Many Republican lawmakers view Medicaid expansion as a risky financial commitment that could saddle the state with huge costs in the future. Meanwhile, Democrats and supporters of expanding Medicaid coverage for more low-income and vulnerable Utahns say valuable time has been wasted and it's a life-and-death matter that needs to be solved. Today, discussing the latest on Medicaid expansion is Salt Lake City Senator Brian Shiazawa, also Representative Marie Paulson, who represents Cottonwood Heights, and Laura Summers, a senior director with the Levitt Group. She has researched state-level health reform with a focus on Medicaid and health insurance exchanges. And this panel was moderated by Riley Curtis, a Medicaid policy analyst with the Utah Health Policy Project. Also, a note to listeners, this entire discussion can be found on kcpw.org. Here is the moderator, Riley Curtis.
Really quickly, I think it's helpful to provide just a brief history of this long, drawn-out debate, both on the federal and on the state level. So I'm going to go over as quickly as I can and comprehensively. So the ACA was passed in 2010, and multiple states, including the state of Utah, challenged the constitutionality of the ACA and took it to the Supreme Court. In 2012, SCOTUS upheld the ACA but made expansion optional for states to implement. They determined that it wasn't constitutional to punish states for not expanding Medicaid, but they also left the incentives in place for states to expand Medicaid. As far as state history, in 2013, the Utah State Legislature signed into law HB 391, which made any type of Medicaid expansion mandatory for the legislative body to approve. A lot of people ask, why can't Governor Herbert go it alone? It's because of that bill. In 2014, Utah legislature considered a partial expansion of Medicaid, Access Utah, which would have expanded PCN, Healthy Utah was proposed, but no bill was passed. And in 2015, the Utah legislature considered Frel Utah, a traditional expansion, Healthy Utah, which Senator Shiazawa ran that bill, and HB 446, which was kind of a quasi-PCN expansion and a Medicaid expansion. But again, no bill was passed. So this is the last thing I'll say, and we'll start asking questions. At the end of 2015, HCR 12, it's a joint resolution passed by both the House and the Senate, was passed, creating what's called or referred to as the Gang of Six, which is made up of the governor, the lieutenant governor, Senate President Niederhauser, Speaker of the House, Greg Hughes, HB 446 sponsor House Majority Leader Jim Dunnigan, and then SB 164 bill sponsor Senator Shiazawa. So they have been meeting over the last summer to come to find a proposal that will work for the state of Utah. So with that, on Tuesday night, the new proposal from the Gang of Six was proposed and explained to caucuses in the Senate and the House, Republican and Democrat, and I would love if Senator Shiazawa would start us off by explaining what the new proposal looks like.
The agreement of the group, or the gang, if you will, is basically this. It's Healthy Utah with a few new waivers, and that's conceptually what it is. And then the big difference is the funding mechanism. And I'd be happy to elaborate on that in more detail as we talk about it. But it is just like Riley has said, and I want to thank her for advocacy on the Hill. She's done the particular population and the coverage gap. She's been a very great advocate for this particular group of patients. And so that's basically the proposal. It was rolled out to the Senate. It was rolled out by myself and President Niederhauser, and both to the Senate Republicans in that closed caucus and into the Senate Democrats in their open caucus. We discussed the concepts again, which are basically the coverage gap, who's covered, under what benefit plans, and then also the waivers that we're considering adding to this particular bill that may or may not be unique to this particular bill this year as it go forth, and then the funding mechanism. That's the fundamentals, what we brought out.
So if you wouldn't mind, let's talk about the funding mechanism. And you know, I think that there's a lot of contention from the medical community, and you might have something to say either as a senator or as an emergency room physician about how providers are being asked to help fund this proposal. And then I think we want to have Laura comment on maybe what CMS, the federal government, might say about that funding mechanism.
Well, you're certainly getting right to the heart of the matter. The key to the passage of this bill, there's a lot of, let me just say this if I can. Let me tell you, there's those things that make the Medicaid expansion, I think, why we ought to do it, and then there's the objections. So let me just talk to you a little bit about the objections, and then maybe that will help us understand a little bit about the funding. Some of the major concerns about a Medicaid expansion in the state of Utah is, not this year so much, but in 2021, in 5 years, the state has the potential liability of a 10% match of the Medicaid dollars that come to the state. That's a significant amount of money. On our calculations, we estimate that that's going to be about $50 million in 2021. Okay? And as you know, the Medicaid, as it's been proposed and as its appeal to the various states is, right now we have 100% match of the Medicaid to the state. All our costs are just administrative. So, for example, this year, if we had adopted that Medicaid expansion, it would have cost us about $3 million to administer this. This with Department of Workforce Services to administer this, determine eligibility, and to roll the program out. About $3 million. What it would brought back to the state is about $400 to $500 million from federal match. Now, those are the facts, and they're indisputable. Now, what are the objections to that? Well, part of it is, what if, as we enroll patients into this expansion population, and thank you for this graph, because it even takes me a while to remember who's involved in this. But if you think about the Medicaid expansion, it's what? Medicaid patients are basically patients who don't have a lot of money. A single person like yourself, or I'm sorry, maybe you're not single, but a single adult without children, under $11,700 more or less, would not be eligible for state assistance if you did not have health care insurance. And if you did have children, if you up to 50% of that level, and above that, you wouldn't be eligible. So if you made more than, say, $6,000, let's say, for the sake of argument, so you wouldn't be eligible. So that the concern is, though, if we opened up this program, that more and more people would choose to be enrolled in this, and the state's fraction would expand with the expansion population, and the cost of the state would go up, potentially more than $50 million. We've seen it in other states, in fairness, like Illinois, for example. Their costs have really gone up quite a bit. And that can be a strain on the state budget. For example, if we have a fixed state budget this year, around $14 billion, and we have to take money from, and I know one of your real concerns is education. What if we took money from education, transportation, or some other vital program, okay? So that's one of the big concerns, is that there, and employers might jump their insurance to say, hey, I don't have to pay for these employees, I'm just gonna put it on the state and they'll pay for it. So expanding that population and hence the cost to the state. Anyway, there's some of the philosophical objections to it. And I support the Medicaid expansion for two and only two reasons at this point. The first reason is there is a coverage gap of people, Utah citizens, who currently are poor and do not have access to health care. And let me say this. I'm not going to talk about health insurance. I'm going to talk about health care. Can you get health care? You bet you can. Yeah, whether or not you have insurance, all you got to do is show up in the ER, and I'll treat you, or one of my partners will treat you. You'll get a bill later, but you'll be stabilized. So you do have a safety net of health care. Maybe you could go to a charity care clinic. Maybe you could work something out with your doctor, PA, whoever you go to. But there is health care available. What this would do, though, is give you health insurance that would help pay those bills and increase affordable access to you if you found yourself in that position. And there is a clear correlation between health outcomes in terms of decreased morbidity, mortality, in other words, better health if you have health insurance. And that fact is non-disputable. So that's basically the idea. So then the key comes to this, Riley. How are we going to pay for this? Not necessarily today, because we have the money. We can afford $3 million, especially when we're drawing down $500 million from the federal government. The state revenues alone on this, through job creation, let's say, we would estimate conservatively 2,000 new jobs, state of Utah, as soon as we draw this down. High-quality paying jobs. I'm chairman of the Business Economic Development Labor Appropriations. This is my area of expertise in terms of funding. I'm looking for businesses to move into this state that bring money in here and guarantee jobs that are sustainable to the state of Utah. This would net us a $500 million company coming in with 2,000 new jobs, and those revenues alone between $7 and $15 million just in state, well, in funding to probably the general fund. So there's no question that there would be the money in terms of funding for this. The problem is you've got to get the legislature, both houses, Senate and the House, to agree on how this should be funded. And not necessarily today, but in 5 years when there's $50 million or more on the table. Ron, I'm taking a lot of time on this, so.
Well, so I think
I can let other people talk, but that's the crux of your matter when you talk about funding. So and I'm willing to let these other experts opine on this. But since I've been in the bill sponsoring in months of meetings, you're getting a little bit of a debriefing from me about what's been going on.
Which I think we all appreciate.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, so I think Representative Paulson wanted to say a couple words.
Take your time.
Yes. I wanted to add, though, I really appreciate Senator Shiozawa's expertise on this, but I've been serving on the Health Reform Task Force for well over 2 years as we've debated this, and it's been a very frustrating experience. As you know, and as he has explained, we've forfeited a lot of money as we've deliberated from the federal government that we've already paid in taxes, millions per month, as we've deliberated this, money that could have gone into the economy. The funding mechanism, I just want to comment on the funding mechanism. One of the great concerns, and I think one of the big obstacles for us in the Health Reform Task Force in coming to a consensus on Medicaid expansion is the idea that they feel like that if we offer this program, we will have a lot of people coming out of the woodwork, you know, people that we hadn't anticipated taking care of Medicaid expansion. And because of this, that's been the concern, the cost to the state. You have to understand, though, that the cost to the state is only 10%. The feds provide a 90-10 match. And so the economic benefit from doing this is far greater than the cost to the state. But under this proposed plan, and granted, I don't have all the details, as Senator Shiozawa does, because it was turned out. It was rolled out in a closed caucus in the Republican House, and so the other part was not allowed to be part of this discussion. But the big concern with this is the funding mechanism, and what this includes is a tax or a fee on providers in the license, in their licensure, and also hospitals. And I've been hearing in the last few days these many physicians, like Senator Shiozawa and my family. I represent a family of four generations of healthcare providers who have great concerns over this funding mechanism. The other concern that I would just like to share too is this: doing this as we go forward, it has potential of pulling what the Healthy Utah does, which I supported, and also the original Medicaid expansion as prescribed by the ACA. What Healthy Utah does, different from just traditional Medicaid expansion, is it pulls those federal dollars and puts them as subsidies through the private insurance market. And so I do have a great concern if we are funding the state's portion of this with the tax on providers, we also are ignoring perhaps the fact that our insurance providers have a real ability to make a lot of money from these federal healthcare dollars, and perhaps they should be involved in the funding mechanism. And there are some changes with the insurance providers, but you know, there are a lot of concerns as we go forward. And I, again, don't want to take all the time, so I'll allow Laura to comment as well.
Yeah, did you want me to comment on that? Or?
Yeah, I think that's actually a great jumping off point. How about that? I mean, there's 29 states and DC who have all expanded Medicaid. A lot of them have done it through a traditional Medicaid expansion, but that's not what we're talking about with this Utah Access Plus or under the Healthy Utah Plan. So if you could, like, 3 to 4 points of what a private expansion plan is, and then maybe a comment or two on the, which is hard, but on the financing mechanism for this new proposal.
Sure, yeah, I'll try to explain it sort of as easily and concisely as I can. So traditional Medicaid expansions, what they're doing is they're taking the Medicaid expansion population, so it's the adults with income up to 133 or 138% FPL, and they're basically just putting them into their regular Medicaid plan. So it's paid for by the state, or through Medicaid managed care plans if the state is using those. What the state of Utah is proposing, and what you've seen happen in a couple of other states who are going this alternative route, is they are actually taking the money that would have been given to the state for this newly eligible population, and instead giving it to health insurance plans that are operating on the exchange or operating in some other sort of private cover option proposal. So I think in Utah it would be operating through Avenue H, which is Utah's small business exchange. So rather than this, the money going directly to the state and the state distributing it to the managed care plans, it would go to the managed care plans. The Medicaid patients or the Medicaid population would still have all of their coverage covered, you know, except for some nominal cost sharing provisions, but it would be functioning through the exchange and through those private insurance plans. The reasoning behind this is a couple of reasons. One, to help reduce churn. So if people who are especially close to that 138% FPL or have close to the $11,000, as they move between becoming eligible and not Medicaid eligible, you know, there is some thought that they could maintain consistency in their plans, so they're not having to jump between Medicaid, private insurance, back to Medicaid. Hopefully they could stay on the same plan. The other aspect is just to get them more used to operate under traditional commercial insurance. So rather than being on a separate Medicaid plan, they get the feel of being insurance, they get the feel of how that may operate, and again, just sort of help with that churn. So the other couple of states that have attempted this is Arkansas, and there's been a lot of news and some differing views on whether Arkansas has been successful or not. Initially, Arkansas's costs were higher than expected in their private option. However, those costs have come down significantly over the last year and are now actually below what the state was estimating for the second year, which I think is typical of what you've seen in states that have gone a traditional expansion route as well. Just anytime you have people who have not received health care for years, all of a sudden they have access to healthcare, you are going to see an increase in cost because people are going to be going to doctors, they're going to be finally getting the medication that they need, et cetera. The other state that has attempted this is Iowa. They have actually moved away from it. They set their program up a little bit different where they were restricting it to two plans. One was a co-op, which is sort of a different conversation all of itself, but it was a health insurance plan that was sort of financed by the government. That plan was not successful, so they pretty much had to close, which left the state of Iowa with only one plan, and they just felt like it was too difficult to keep operating under that model, so they moved everyone to traditional managed care models. So, you know, definitely a lot of different views on whether it's been successful or not. With only a couple states really attempting it, I think it's hard to tell. Some people would say Arkansas has not been successful because the costs were initially high, but if you look at it today, I think the state would argue it's been successful, although they're now looking at sort of an overall sort of healthcare transformation reform to replace the private option. So,
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. Today we are airing a discussion recorded last week on the latest proposal for expanding Medicaid in Utah. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. If you're just joining us, last week a group of Utah lawmakers and healthcare policy analysts gathered to discuss the latest proposal to expand Medicaid for low-income Utahns, branded as Utah Access Plus. The panel includes Senator Brian Shiazawa, Representative Marie Paulson, Laura Summers, a healthcare policy analyst with the Levitt Group, and the panel was moderated by Riley Curtis, a Medicaid policy analyst with the Utah Health Policy Project.
I want to go back to something that Representative Paulson said about the plan, this new plan being rolled out in a very private way, locking out, you know, essentially the House Democrats from this process, and Democrats completely, with the G6 being made up only of Republican leaders. So my question is to Senator Shiazawa. There's been a lot of public concern and outcry about the private nature of these most recent negotiations, and you being part of the Gang of Six, what do you say about the need of having these negotiations and the manner in which they were conducted? I mean, do you think that it was beneficial to close it off and get the conversations done, or do you think there could have been more room for more voices, potentially?
Well, now that is a loaded question for Republican among a bunch of Democrats.
UHPP is nonpartisan, by the way.
let me just say this. I really believe in transparency. And as Representative Paulson will tell you, I have no problem with being very candid with people about what a program is and what it should be or should not be. Now, how this was conducted was not my direction. This was called by the governor and put on by the leadership of the House and the Senate. Now, having said that, should this and could this have been done differently? Yes, it could have been. Could that have included, say, a member of the House Democrat leadership as well as their Senate leadership? You bet it could have been. And I don't offer an apology to that. I just wasn't in the actual formatting of these meetings, but it would not have bothered me one bit to have had input from these individuals. I guess if I can say one grace of the way the governor put this together initially was that his intent was to get an expansion. That was the idea. And then to bring the two houses together, the Senate and the House, so that we could agree and finally come up with a consensus that would then pass both bodies. Because that was really the issue. It passed the Senate. We had the support. And we took it to the House and it was blocked and never made it in there. And that's basically the same roadblock we're facing right now. And if you've kept up with this in the Tribune, you'll see that it was met with a lukewarm response within the House GOP. And I'm not even sure it was rolled out in front of the Democrats in the House. So you guys are still in the dark. But we did. I took this up on that same day, simultaneously to the Senate Democrats to do this. But having said that, Riley, basically, people, we got to keep our eye on the ball. Our objective is what, or at least my objective was this: get a Medicaid expansion to the state of Utah, and figure out the waivers that would make it politically palatable to those conservative and concerned people in the both bodies, and then arrive at a funding mechanism that would also pass both houses. And that was my objective, and I think that's honestly the governor's objective when we convened these meetings. It was not, at least from my perspective, exclusionary. It was for that objective. Now, to the extent that it could have been done better, and I think time will tell, could this have been done better? The bill has not passed and has some significant challenges coming up next few days. And I'm honestly looking forward with mixed emotions to testifying before the Health Reform Task Force next Tuesday when this plan is rolled out publicly, although there hasn't been much in the way of secrecy about the details. We pretty much know what the plan is. It's Healthy Utah with different funding mechanism. And the key points are gonna be just this. If you didn't like Healthy Utah, and you were against the expansion, you're probably still against it. And if you had concerns additionally on the funding mechanism, I guarantee you'll have some real concerns about this funding mechanism. So that's basically my view on that. So if that helps.
It does.
I'll hand the microphone over to my colleague.
And I will represent the House Democrats that were shut out of this process. I do have to say, in Senator Shiozawa's behalf, we are neighbors and friends of many years and have represent the same constituency, that he's always been very candid, and we've had many discussions about the negotiations, and he's been very candid with me. But it is a problem, I think, that these this rolling this out in a closed door, I think, creates suspicions among the public. In our caucus in the House, that we always, every meeting is open to the press and the public, all of our caucus meetings, because we believe strongly in transparency, that government should be done in the open all of the time. And so that does come to be a frustration for us. The House Democrats were very much in support of Healthy Utah and I collaborated with Senator Shiozawa to get this past the House, and I admit that the House were the ones that prevented Healthy Utah from going forward in this last session, really put up the roadblock for Healthy Utah. I think that has been a problem. And I think as we go forward, the way this is put together, the funding mechanism is going to create a problem for those that were already against it. And some of those just as a political statement against the current administration, and then some that have supported it that have concerns about the funding mechanism. And I do have some great concerns about that. Laura, did you want
to? So I'm going to ask Laura one question, and then I think we want to open it up for public questions as well. You know, we've got this process going forward. We've got this health reform task force coming up on Tuesday where the public can provide input. It sounds like Senator Shiozawa is going to help present the bill, the proposal. So say in a perfect world we get this passed, there's still another hurdle that we do have to overcome. From your perspective, looking at different states and state policies and how they play well or not well with CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, what do you think about, what's the process like if we get it out of the House, and what does it look like with the feds?
Yeah, so absolutely. So after the state approves a bill, you know, once a bill is developed, we get signed off on the bill, the next step would then be developing an 1115 Medicaid waiver that would go to CMS to be approved. I think if the bill or the proposal looks fairly similar to Healthy Utah, my sense is they could probably get a waiver drafted fairly quickly, but that would be the next process. And even before it goes to CMS, it goes for a 30-day public comment period here in the state of Utah, where it would be open for public comment here. It would then go to CMS, where certain aspects would be negotiated, and I know that there has been mention of some provisions in the Healthy Utah or the new proposal that CMS may have some concerns with, and maybe Representative or Senator Shiozawa can speak to some of those. But you know, CMS has in the past has approved some provisions that people thought would never have been approved before. So the state of Indiana, for example, was asking for co-payments that were higher than what had been allowed under CMS regulations. They were able to get some of that approved. They were asking for a waiver of certain benefits that had never been allowed before that CMS approved. So I would certainly say that nothing is off the table. However, there are some things that CMS has come down pretty strict on, and you know, really, it depends sort of on a detail-by-detail basis, but anytime that there is sort of harm to beneficiaries, restricting access to beneficiaries, you know, CMS will have a hard time with that. So I don't know how much the state of Utah has negotiated with CMS on some of those provisions. Certainly, if those negotiations have happened before, that can help streamline the process, but you know, that could take another several months, 2 to 3 months to even a year to have those negotiations to maybe get to a point where CMS and the state of Utah are comfortable. It will then, somewhere in that process, it is then open to a federal public comment period, another 30-day public comment period, where it's open at the federal level, and then it would ultimately be approved if the state of Utah and CMS are able to come to an agreement. So you know, even if the state passes the bill, there certainly is a lengthy process to get the plan approved and get it implemented. And then, you know, there certainly are, if there are any changes to administrative functions within the state of Utah as well, those would have to be considered and put into place as well. So
it's been a long, winding, bumpy road to this point, and there's still a few hurdles we still have to come over, the House and the federal approval of the waiver. So are there any questions that the audience would like to ask?
Hi, I'm Andy Ho. I'm a student here at the university. My question for you guys is, with this new plan coming out with the Utah Access, a big problem with a problem that I saw was cost shifting. So with the costs, are these costs being shifted to physicians, doctors, hospitals? And if so, how receptive are they to these new costs?
Who would like to?
I'll come in. And I'm sure you have. I've been hearing from all of the physicians in my district with this, and there are some concerns with this. I have family members that are in healthcare, and I know that the reimbursement for Medicaid for providers is very low. Now, oftentimes that reimbursement does not cover overhead for the providers. Granted, with this new plan, that will increase, but the percentage, many are worried about the percentage. The other thing I'm hearing is that not all physicians, not all providers will see Medicaid patients, but they're all taxed for this, and they're very unhappy about that. For example, pediatricians see children, and we're talking about adults with the expansion, and they will get taxed for this. The other thing I'm hearing a lot is that a lot of providers keep their licenses after they retire, and these providers provide charity care in the clinics throughout the state. Many of them go on LDS humanitarian missions. They keep this license, and they use this to give back. But I've heard from many of those that said that they would discontinue their licenses because it would up their licensure fee $800 to $1,000 a year, and they wonder whether this is worth them doing for the charity care that they do. So it could decrease the access to that. And so many of these providers have great concerns about the way that we're funding this. And the other thing I'm hearing too is, what if our estimations of the people covered are way overestimated? And what will happen if we impose this tax or fee, whatever you want to call it, on all of these providers? What happens if we have an excess in funds? What will happen to this excess in funds? Will this tax go on in perpetuity if the money really isn't, that much money is not needed to fund this? The other concern is about insurance companies sharing in the cost and whether that's an adequate sharing. I'm sure you have plenty to say.
For the public record, I will say that this proposal of funding was the only one that would gain the support of both bodies in order for it to proceed. Now, having said that, I'm going to talk as an individual legislator and as a Utah citizen. When you come out of med school and residency, a lot of kids will have $250,000 or more in debt. And we have a strategic problem here. We don't have enough primary care doctors in the state of Utah. And to raise a fee so high can not only endanger the retention of those doctors that we have, but also recruiting new doctors into many fields that we desperately need. Now, I don't know how many of you have health issues, but try to get in to see your primary care doctor on a timely basis.
ERs flourish because people don't have affordable access. That's why our volumes keep going up every year, because people have no other place to go. And so you get episodic, expensive, and frankly, and I can say this, being an emergency physician, this is not the best care. We'll do our best to stabilize you. But the fact is, you ought to have a relationship with your primary care provider, your OB, pediatrician, whoever it is. And if we don't have enough doctors and providers for health care, this is a big deal. And so that's one of the concerns I have on this funding. The other strategic thing is just how this bill goes forth, and that is, if you get enough opponents to a bill, it will die as a result of that opposition. And so from a strategic standpoint, this is a stumbling block. And so that's the concern also I would have. I support this bill. I support Medicaid expansion precisely for that reason, that it will expand the care of health care, not just health insurance, but health care, you guys. And there's a difference. When you have health insurance, you have access. And if you don't have health insurance, you don't have access. And if you have diabetes, hypertension, you may have a cancer, and you can't get a colonoscopy, you have chest pain, you don't have adequate care of your diabetes or other health problems, you're going to suffer and you're going to die. And the statistics are there. And then there's the money issue, the financial issue that we've already delineated. So that's a very perceptive comment on, is this a fair assessment? If you look at it from one perspective, that those who benefit from Medicaid dollars, in other words, the new dollars that come back from the state, would contribute back to help fund this. That's an argument in favor of that particular model. I would alter that model because there's uncompensated care. There's lots of other factors. Hospitals will be clearly the big beneficiaries of this. And in other states, for example, we talk about Republican states have passed this, hospitals have voluntarily come forth and to have taken on the entire burden. Why? Because they'll not only recognize the philosophical benefits of this bill, of this concept of taking care of the uncompensated care, but they also know their margins are going to improve drastically and they can afford. I could go on, but that's enough.
If you're just tuning in this morning, this is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. Last week, Senator Brian Chiazawa, Representative Marie Paulson, and Laura Summers, a healthcare policy analyst with the Levitt Group, gathered to discuss the latest proposal to expand Medicaid for low-income Utahns that's being called Utah Access Plus. The panel was moderated by Riley Curtis. Just a note to listeners, in the next question, Riley mentions CMS in her question. That refers to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, the federal agency within the Department of Health and Human Services that works with states to administer the Medicaid program.
So I wonder if Laura actually could talk about what CMS has approved by way of cost sharing for consumers in the gap in the expansion population.
Sure. So what they've approved in the past, well, there's the regulations were recently redone about a year or two ago. And so the new definitions were set in that. And CMS, you know, came out pretty strong and clear that they weren't going to approve anything higher than that. What they have allowed in the last couple of years is, one, the establishment of premiums. And this is typically only for individuals between 100 and 138% FPL. So anyone below 100% really is exempt from premiums. Now, states have gotten a little creative in how they've done that in terms of establishing HSAs or other cost sharing, but it's really tied to just that 100 to 138% FPL. I'd say the biggest change that they've allowed is the regulation used to only allow, I think it was an $8 copayment for non-emergent use of the emergency room. A couple of states were able to get that increased to $10. So a $10 or it actually may have been higher than that. I think Indiana's was maybe around $20, but a much higher copayment for non-emergent use of the emergency room. Now, there are other stipulations around that. So, like, the first time you're not charged, so it's depending on when you – it's designed for those repeat offenders who continually come back and back to the ER. I think it's just important to note that a lot of this, you know, $10 certainly does not sound very high, but you have to think about it in terms of context. That one, this is a population with very limited access to income, so $10, $20 can be a substantial amount for those people to afford. If they're paying premiums that are, CMS has not allowed premiums to go above 2% of their income or 5% of their annual income, depending on how it's defined. Again, doesn't sound like a lot, but when you're thinking of this population, you know, those small amounts can add up to quite a bit. And then the other thing to think about, you know, it's typically done to, again, get people to think about things in terms of commercial insurance, to get people ready to pay commercial insurance type payments as they move off Medicaid and move into traditional insurance. But there is a big administrative component for the state and for the providers in terms of collecting those amounts. So you do have to think about, is it worth my time to collect a $10 copay? Is it worth the time of the state to collect a $10 copay? So it's really balancing the political dynamics of wanting to get it done, wanting to make people more accountable for their insurance, make them more aware of how traditional insurance works, versus more of the practical component of, you know, is it, can people really afford it? And then two, is it worth the state's and the provider's time in terms of collecting those? So
Senator Shiazawa, really quickly, is Utah Access Plus, the population they're asking to participate in the cost sharing, is it any different than what Laura just described, or is it only for the 100 to 138 population as in other states?
The waivers is what Riley's referring to, and there's a number of waivers. The particular cost sharing issue and the issue with the children, these are conceptual. This bill is not even drafted yet. We're drafting it right now, and so these are concepts that we're rolling out. The issue with the children, this could easily be in May. It doesn't even have to be in the bill. I don't want this to be a stumbling block for proceeding to completion or not. And the only justification in my mind for this is some families would have two forms of insurance, and if you go to a family doctor, then the children could go and be seen at the same time if they needed to, along with their parents. And so there would be a continuity of care. If you are a mom who just delivered, they could also give you the postnatal care and your pediatric care ongoing. So there was the advantage of continuity of care, which you know is a big deal in medical parlance. So that's not a deal breaker. And in terms of the copays, a lot of these copays were and different waivers were already approved for Healthy Utah, so we're not adding that much. One that I've thought would be a real good idea is a bifurcation of the medically frail into standard ACOs, the Accountable Care Organizations, managed care for these medically frail, because these are people who utilize the system more and have higher costs, but then they need more management, more case management, and have people following their care more closely than they say maybe if you had no health insurance or no health major health problems, and you'd only go in if, say, you had chest pain or maybe had to have an appendix removed. So those are vastly different populations, and by bifurcating that, you could have commercial insurance groups actually come into the state, as they do in Arkansas, to flatten out the cost curves. You guys, if you look at it, the current cost of healthcare in the United States is the biggest fraction of GDP that it is in the industrial world, and that's not right. And your costs under Obamacare are just going to go up, 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 and up, and hence the irony of the word affordable care. But that fact notwithstanding, that's the law. Whether you like it or not, whether you agree with it or not, that's the law. And we've been tasked to deal with this particular problem. And we can deal with it or we can ignore it. And that's the choice you have. We can deliver health care and help the benefits, get quality care and save some lives, prevent people from coming to the ER, and draw down a huge amount of money from the federal government. Or we can sit back and say, hell no, this is Obamacare and I won't be a participant in that.
Let the record show that Senator Shiazawa said the H word.
Sorry.
Let's do one more question. I think we have time for one more.
Hello, my name is Paul Gibbs. I'm a filmmaker who made a documentary about people in coverage gap, and now I am on the executive committee of LDS Dems, and I'm also the vice chair of the Democratic Healthcare Caucus. Seeing as how, at this point, so many of us who have supported either straight Medicaid expansion or Healthy Utah have concerns about whether we support the new funding mechanism, what happens, what's our alternative if this plan doesn't go through? I hear a lot of supporters wanting to go back to healthy Utah straight expansion. As Representative Polson pointed out, there is opposition here that's purely ideological. Now, having seen so much of that, I don't see these people, these legislators, suddenly changing their mind. They've had the financial benefits, in fact, explained very well by people like Riley. They've seen the human face over and over again. I know because I'm one of the people who's brought it to them. There are legislators who, to put it bluntly, I feel, are not going to recognize the benefits of this if they walk up and bite them. So do we think that there's any realistic chance of getting them to consider either Healthy Utah or Medicaid expansion again? And if not, are we just dead with this if the new plan doesn't happen?
Just adding on your, you know, working on that task force for so long, it you can't do that without just having your heart touched by these people in need that we see so often. And the great sadness to me about this whole process has been is that all of this time, as we have deliberated, we have lost millions and millions of dollars that we have already paid in taxes that could have come back to our state to help these people. And so I oftentimes am concerned that, like, the funding mechanism or some of the roadblocks are some sort of strategy to defeat this program altogether. And I hope that's not the case. I really hope that's not the case. I hope that the people of the state of Utah, our legislature, is committed to the fact of providing care for these people, that we will continue to work on this until we get something that will aid these people. But I am concerned that as we make this more and more complicated, that it may defeat the process altogether, and that might be a strategy because that's there. It keeps me up at night, I have to tell you.
So we learned from Laura what happens if the House does move forward with the proposal, but I want to hear from Senator Shiazawa just to elaborate what happens if it does not come out of a committee vote favorably and we don't get a special session.
I don't know. There is always another session. And one of the concerns that I'm hearing is 2016, maybe a Republican in the White House. Right now, Republicans have the majority in the Senate, not a veto-proof majority, and Republicans in the House have a majority. But because there's a Democrat in the White House and a Republican Congress, the ACA or Obamacare, however you refer to it, is going to be the law until such time as it's either A, overturned by the Supreme Court or modified some way judicially, or there's some legislative will to change it. But for right now, it's the law. Now, having said that, 2016, if there's a change, many of the people who oppose this will say, well, let's wait and see. We're close to the elections next November, 2016. We will know whether there's a Republican in there, and if there is, much like if King v. Burwell prevails, depending on which side you were cheering for, then that would have been a demise of the exchanges. So in other words, a wait-and-see attitude on that. The funding mechanism, though, it has added a whole new dimension, Riley, in terms of the complexity of this. And you guys, in order to get a bill passed, you have to have the concepts clear, understandable, in order for these things to go forth. And if you complicate things too much, then it really does invite more pitfalls to a particular piece of legislation. And I'm going to leave it at that.
So I know that we've got 3 minutes left, and I have a question that I'm dying to ask, and I hope that you'll still be my friend afterward. But
you talking to me?
Yes. So
That would be hard to that would be hard to accomplish,
really. I mean, we've heard from Representative Dunnigan. We haven't heard much from Speaker Hughes after the caucus the other night, but we heard from Representative Dunnigan a number of times that they are not going to whip the votes in their caucus, that they've asked their caucus to vote on their conscience. And I am just wondering, who is our leader that can get this done in the House? Who, or is it someone from the outside? Like, what are we, who are we to look to as the public, as organizations, to get this done? Because we, it has been the culmination of 3 years now. How do we finally get this done in Utah if we don't have a leader championing it?
I'm looking for that leader on this area. I can tell you that my caucus has been totally committed to getting this, you know, taking advantage of the Medicaid expansion. But serving in the House, that's been a great frustration, because we have been the stumbling block. The House leadership has been the stumbling block with this, and so that's a challenge. Let's do something. Let's get this moving forward. It needs to be done.
Just a note to listeners, by the time of this broadcast, a public comment hearing mentioned during this taped discussion was held yesterday, Tuesday, October 6th, at the Utah State Capitol. We have to wrap things up here. The entire discussion can be found on our website, kcpw.org. Thank you today to Alliance for a Better Utah and the LDS Democratic Caucus for helping to organize this event. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Ross Chambliss, producer and host. Catch you next week.